This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The Jim Day Podcast is brought to you by Kroger. Fresh for everyone.
Now batting number one in our hearts. At least he'd like to think so. It's the Jim Day Podcast.
Hi again, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Jim Day Podcast. Thanks for checking us out wherever you are checking us out. And we are worldwide. And we've said that before. We have, I've said this a thousand times, that we have this treat and that treat. But to me, as a broadcasting nerd, this is a massive treat. And I hope it is for you as well. He is a Bengals legend. Four times he went to the Pro Bowl. A longtime NFL analyst, has some Super Bowls to his credit, golf, Olympics. I mean, this guy's done it all, and a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, is a winner of the Pete Rozelle Award for Excellence in Broadcasting. But anyone around Cincinnati and those that have lived and died by 700 WLW over the years know him as one of the godfathers, if not the godfather, of sports talk. He is Mr. Bob Trumpy. Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, Jim. Thank you for that. That what you just described incorporates an awful lot of years.
Oh, it's your resume is unbelievable. I mean, you know, some people might think, oh yeah, I did sports talk for a long time, but there was so much more that you did. As you look back, is it unbelievable what you accomplished in broadcasting?
The opportunity is the unbelievable part. I don't know if you know the story, but I was still a player with the Bengals, and my wife's family lived in Southern California. So after the football season, we generally went out there, even with our two boys, for 6 weeks after the football season was over, and then we'd come back and do something. I go out to Los Angeles in 1975. And turn on the radio, because you're always on the freeway somewhere in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And Bill Russell, the retired center of the Boston Celtics, the Hall of Famer, had a radio show on this radio station that I stumbled across. And I don't remember the name of the radio station or the call letters or anything like that. But I started listening to him, and I wasn't really interested in what he was talking about. He sounded like he was having a great time. And that's what sold me on the idea of, wait a minute, would that work in Cincinnati? And, of course, I'm sitting in Los Angeles. What is that, 20 million people, 15 yeah. million people?
It's a whole lot more than Cincinnati.
And freeways everywhere, and to do anything in Los Angeles, you got to be on the freeway, so people are in the cars a lot. And I think, well, Cincinnati has Columbus on the north, Louisville, Lexington on the south, Indianapolis on the west, and kind of Pittsburgh and West Virginia on the east. Would that total reach what L.A. does? Because half of L.A. is the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
You know? So I mentioned it to my wife, and she said, radio, what do you mean radio? You're going to be a disc jockey? No, I don't think I'll be a disc jockey. Anyway, come
you
back.
You got the pipes for it, though.
Come back to Cincinnati and approach WLW Radio, who then had the Reds, had the Bengals, and a guy named Charlie Murdoch, who was certainly famous in Cincinnati radio, was interested until he mentioned it to the parties that they carry, the Cincinnati Reds and the Cincinnati Bengals. And suddenly, I was no longer a prospect for doing a sports talk show in Cincinnati. So I had to go to another station, and I went to WCKY. And at that time, they were literally playing albums, elevator music, however you want to describe it. But they did carry, they were a CBS radio affiliate, they did carry Monday Night Football during the football season, Jack Buck and Hank Stram. So there was that much sports on this station. They had a guy named Bill Sorrell who did the sports and smoked a pipe and was a terrific guy. And I started my career being a guest on an hour-long show on WCKY one night a week. And that started my career. I mean, as soon as I started doing it, I loved it. It was great fun, and I had wonderful contacts with Reds players, and that helped. They helped. And so that began it. And then it was a totally accidental career that ended up being 30-plus years broadcasting for the local radio stations and NBC and CBS and whatever else, doing golf, the Olympics, anthology stuff that they wanted me to do. It was not what I intended, but it's what I ended up with.
It's terrific. And,
how did you start? What was your first break?
Oh, wow. You know, I have never told this story before. It's interesting that you ask this. I'm working. I'm still in college. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah, I know that. Westerville.
Wow, nice job. Yes, from the Ville.
Graduated from Otterbein.
Wow, you like Googled me or something. I was going. It was then Otterbein College. It's now Otterbein University. So I went there because it was a small school and they had a pretty decent broadcasting department where you could get hands-on right away. You know, it was all about getting a tape then. So I started working covering high school sports when I was a junior. I interned early. I decided, you know, I'm not going to wait around. I'm going to try to get experience. So I ended up getting a job as a producer at one of the local affiliates. It was the ABC affiliate. And I wasn't on air. I was producing, but I was a senior in college, and I was trying to decide, wow, I already got a job here. I don't know why I need a degree. But I was going to school full-time. I had like 15 to 18 hours worth of classes. Plus, I was working 50, 60 hours a week.
Ooh.
I was just, yeah, my senior year.
You didn't have any weekends, did you?
No, no. Well, I mean, I would come into class, and I'd see everyone. they'd be cramming. You know, right before the class, I'm like, there's a test today? Damn it! I mean, there are days I didn't know there was a test. So I just did what I could to get through. I did get the degree on time. But this was 1990, February. Buster Douglas from Columbus, Ohio, just knocked out Mike Tyson. Biggest upset in boxing history.
Agreed.
Maybe sports history.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Muhammad Ali over Sonny Liston.
Yeah, that's true.
But I agree with you.
Yeah. No, it's up there. It's in the sentence. This happens, and Columbus goes crazy, and all of a sudden we're doing all this programming for Buster Douglas, and he's got all this parade and stuff. And before the fight, he had Don King. Your guy, Don King. Had... By the way, this is supposed to be about you, and now we're making this about
me. No. You don't know what you're going to get on a podcast, so this is what you're getting. Go right ahead.
Don King was managing both Buster Douglas and Mike Tyson and paid no attention to Buster Douglas beforehand. But then all of a sudden, once Buster wins and he's the toast of the town and the toast of the country, he's all of a sudden buddying up to Buster Douglas. So he comes to Columbus, and there's this big to-do about Buster and Don King, and no one could get Don King to talk because he was bad-mouthing Buster, and this was this big controversy. So I went to this event as a producer on a Friday night. I'll never forget it. I believe it was at a local church. And all the reporters are there. And he would talk to no one. And everyone, it was a Friday. So all the reporters left. And I stayed for this event on a Friday night. It was like 3-4 hours. A bunch of local leaders talking. And yeah. Don King was there. And I finally cornered him. And I said, Don, I introduced myself. I know these other reporters will interview you and they might take you out of context. How about you come on the 11 o'clock news live? That way we won't be able to edit you and you can just, we'll give you an open-ended question and you can just say what you want. Thinking that he, if he's going to do it, it's going to be with one of our anchors. And he said, yeah, I'll do that. I like that. And he goes, who's going to do it? And I said, well, the reporter that was here earlier who had ticked him off. You mean that such and such? And he's like, oh, I'll do it, but I'll only do it with you.
Oh, thank you, Don King.
So I call back to the station. Here I am, a senior in college who wants to be on the air. And they're like, oh, yeah, sure, Jim. Yeah. Yeah, he'll only do it with you. Yeah, we believe you. So I had to get on our photographer and another person was out there. And they're like, oh, it's legit. That's what he said. So this was 10:50 p.m. We go on at 11.
Gotcha.
So here I am, and I have I've done stuff in broadcasting. I've never done a live shot on local news. So at the top of the news, I all of a sudden have the story of the week, and I'm live with Don King. And then
yes.
The interview went off great. And
the broadcast career is underway.
Yes. Don King. Don King, of all people, helped start my career.
I mean, but it was your intention to be in broadcasting.
Yes. No, it was my intention to be on the air.
You got an education in broadcasting. But
yeah.
they didn't teach you anything. And I had no broadcasting classes, but I'm sure they didn't teach you anything in broadcasting that you applied in that interview with Don King, right?
None. Nothing in a book can, nothing in a book can teach you how to conduct an interview.
I'm standing here next to Don King, who is the manager of some of the most famous people in the world of boxing.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, here we go.
And I'm this little college kid.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't prepared to be on the air. I didn't have a tie on. I had like this T-shirt and pullover. I wasn't shaved.
He didn't have a tie on either, did he?
Yeah, I wasn't shaved that day. So it was just down and dirty and raw, but everyone was chasing him all week, and I had all of like 5 minutes to prepare.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, you mentioned boxing, and in my case, I had no idea where what I was about to do was going to go, how it was going to travel. I had no clue whatsoever. But when the show, when I moved to WLW from WCKY, it became my show, my responsibility. I had to take care of every second of that radio show. So I got on the phone with an awful lot of people. And you mentioned boxing. I sat in front of Joe Frazier.
Oh, wow.
Leo. Can you hear the family phone ringing?
That's all right, man. This podcast is down and dirty and raw. It doesn't matter.
Leave the phone call in. Anyway, on the phone, I talked to Muhammad Ali. On the phone, I talked to Angelo Dundee, his manager. Doing that radio show for all those years was an absolute safari 5 days a week. I had no idea where it was going. I had a big hand in planning it, but I had absolutely no idea how it was going to go on any night that I went on the air. And I think that was the best thing about the job I had. That's what I loved about doing football, too. I thought was what was going to happen before the game. And then with your broadcast partner, you kind of plan that out. And it either does or doesn't go that way. So it was a safari every time they turned the mic on, and I was there. The only downside, I was gone from my family for birthdays, for anniversaries, for I didn't miss many Christmases, but Thanksgiving, New Year's, I took them with me a lot, but for the most part, I was gone a whole bunch during that time, Jim.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. This year of 2020, and I've been doing Reds baseball, I don't know, for 20 years, I guess, now, and I couldn't remember being home on Memorial Day, Mother's Day, Father's Day, July 4th, certainly not.
That's the downside of it, but I don't know about you, but during my broadcast career, when I traveled, Delta was huge here, and I could get anywhere I needed to go in the NFL without changing planes.
Right.
And you and I both know that is a huge advantage. We always flew first class. We always got picked up by a driver. We didn't have to rent a car. We were treated wonderfully by the networks that I worked for, so that made it as easy as possible. But still, when I'd call home, my wife would always ask me, well, what's the wallpaper look like in your hotel room? Where are the drapes? I was constantly reminded I was not home.
Yeah, there's no doubt. What was it like? This is a broad question, but in the late 60s and the 70s, when you were a player, what was it like in Cincinnati being a professional athlete? And was there much, were you around Reds players much? Pre-broadcasting, did you guys mix and mingle at all, or was it because you had different seasons that you didn't come in contact with the Reds much?
Yeah,
though?
Look, the truth is, we started in 1968, and the Reds' tremendous run started in 70.
Right.
And in the press, we made quite a bit of news because we were new. But look, when the baseball season started, we knew we were the stepsister. No matter what we did, we were not going to get the bulk of the attention. And then, remember, we were both tenants at Riverfront Stadium.
Right.
I made the acquaintance of a guy named Jim Ferguson. Recognize the name?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Red's longtime PR director.
He still comes around, Fergie.
Yep. And I still live in Glendale. I live in Glendale here north of Cincinnati. Dick Wagner lived down the street, and Jim Ferguson hung around Glendale a lot. So we became buddies. We became friends. And he said to me one day, he said, have you ever been in the Reds clubhouse? And this is obviously our off season. And I said, no, I'd love to go. I don't even know where it is in Riverfront Stadium. And he said, well, meet me down there tomorrow. And this was during the baseball season. I said, sure. So I drive down there. He gets me a parking pass and everything is right. And I walk in the door and, oh my God, there's Johnny Bench. There's Tony Perez. There's Pete Rose. And then I noticed the thing that defines what you ask me. What was it like to be a professional athlete in Cincinnati in the 60s and the 70s? In front of George Foster, Concepcion, Bench, Rose, were bushel baskets, literally bushel baskets full of fan mail. It was unbelievable. We had little... down at Spinning Field, we had little cubby holes that were maybe 4 inches by 4 inches.
Yeah.
And we may get a few envelopes in there a week. These Reds players literally had bushel baskets full of fan mail sitting in front of the locker. And I said to Fergie, what is that? Why are those bushel baskets? That's fan mail. What? You got to be kidding me. And I left there thinking, we will never be able to compete press-wise, prestige-wise, with the Cincinnati Reds. It will never come close. This is a professional baseball town. this is, as we learned, one of the greatest assemblages of professional baseball athletes that any franchise had ever assembled. They proved that in the early 70s. And I kind of live with that. And until I started meeting some of the guys on a personal level, Bench and I played in a bunch of golf tournaments sponsored by American Airlines for several years. And then I met Pete Rose, and then Sparky Anderson was still around, and then John McNamara, and then Bill Fisher, and then Tom Seaver was a big nut on USC graduates being drafted by the NFL. But my first impression, Jim, was the bushel baskets full of fan mail.
Wow.
And I, when I walked out of there with Jim Ferguson, I said, look, when I get a fan mail and something to sign, it's a big deal for me. And my wife takes it out of the envelope, signs it, and we religiously send it back. What do these guys do? And he said, well, they have stamps with their names on it. And my daughter, Julie, does Johnny Bench's fan mail. So, it kept hitting me in the face. My God, we are such second-class citizens here. It's unbelievable. But it didn't bother me. I was playing professional football, so yeah. I thought I was a big deal. Nobody else did. But I thought I was a big deal.
Oh, no, you were a big deal. It's changed. The landscape's changed a little bit over the years. The NFL is so big
now.
Yes,
it has. Yes, it has. But again, I mean, we came into existence during a period of time
right.
where the Cincinnati Reds almost owned professional baseball for a period of 6 or 7 years, which is just amazing. It was fun to watch them. I enjoyed it a great deal. They were fun to be around. They were all interested in football. So we got along well.
That's great. Did it help you, since you started dabbling in radio mid-70s or 75, 76, whatever it was, the popularity of the Reds, did that in turn help you?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And the fact that LW was the voice of the Reds, and it was a 50,000-watt clear channel station. And I think when we kept track of who could hear us, and in the winter when the sun went down, we heard from 38 states, and I think three provinces in Canada. So we were heard over two-thirds of the country, like you were sitting next to the
right.
tower. My parents had a vacation place in Dunedin Beach, Florida. They lived in Illinois, and they could drive to this little it was a bridge, but it was a bridge about 100 yards long, and sit on the edge of the bridge and listen to the radio show that I was doing at night from Cincinnati, Ohio. So the power of the radio station, yes, certainly helped. The attention that the Cincinnati Reds got, yes, certainly helped. Pete Rose was a consistent guest on the show as a player, as a manager. I'd see him someplace and say, how about coming on next Tuesday night at 6:30? And he'd be there next Tuesday night at 6:29. He was the most consistent guest. But Tommy Hume was on my radio show an awful lot. We became pretty good friends.
Love Tom Hume.
Yeah, the other thing I got to tell you, Jim, is that I don't remember what year this was, but the radio station came to me and said, because we cover the Reds, we're sending you to Tampa. That's when they were still training in Tampa and living in the Bill Watson's International Inn Motel. We're sending you to Tampa for 2 weeks to cover the Reds. So I did my radio show from by the pool at Bill Watson's International Inn. And that really got me very close to an awful lot of players on the team because they saw me every day, and I hung out in the bullpen at Al Lopez Field, and McNamara was the manager at that time. So it really helped me, really helped the show, and you know, we had an awful good time. We didn't deal as much with baseball as we did with their personalities, so that helped a lot. And that's when I really got to know Brenneman. Until then,
who?
I mean, the old Brenneman, not the young Brenneman.
Oh, I vaguely heard of him.
Yeah. Anyway, I got to know him because my producer Doug Kidd and I would go to every baseball game. We didn't travel; we stayed in Tampa, but we'd sit down in front of Marty every day, all day long, for the games, and then do the radio show at night. And then, you know, we'd have breakfast, lunch, or dinner almost every day. That's when we became friends, buds.
Wow. And, boy,
I'm sure you feel, under normal circumstances, Jim, that you have access to the clubhouse.
Yeah.
You have access to... you're standing there beside the dugout. You can see these guys sweat. I mean, your relationship with the players has got to be a mirror image of what mine was because you're around them so much. By the way, are you allowed in the clubhouse now?
No, we are not. There is no media whatsoever in the clubhouse at all. Closest I come is sitting about seven rows behind the dugout during home games.
Yeah, you can't travel with them.
No, there is not one MLB team that is broadcasting road games. We do the road games from a studio in Cincinnati off of monitors.
I was very anxious to see how that was going to work out, and I noticed when you guys were the team was in Milwaukee, and Chris Welsh and Tom Brenneman were doing the game that they people may or may not know. When you do a home game, you know the producer and director, and you can tell the producer, feature this, watch this guy, and you get used to the way the broadcasters broadcast. But when you're from Cincinnati broadcasting a game televised by a TV crew in Milwaukee,
right,
you may not even know the name of the producer or the director, and they're showing the pictures to favor Milwaukee, not Cincinnati. And I watched it with interest to see how they were going to do it. And actually, I thought Brenneman and Welsh did an excellent job of keeping everybody up to date, but you could tell there was a delay.
Yeah, that's the one thing. There's going to be a little bit of a delay, but there is an edict.
There's no way around that.
Yeah, there is an edict in Major League Baseball. These feeds are universal feeds, so the home team, the truck who's producing the game, has to keep it even as possible to do both teams. So that really, for what I do, when I'm at least doing sidelines and not calling the game, it's tough to be a sideline reporter when you're not actually on the sidelines or you have no access to the players other than a computer interview, you know, and like, you know, just hanging out with those players like you did in Tampa, a lot of the information you get is just shooting the breeze.
Absolutely.
Standing
you
around spring
100%
training.
Correct. And if you, I'm sure you feel like if you don't have the access to the players that you used to have, you feel like, man, I'm not doing my job here.
I walk out of there after every game like, wow, that stunk. I feel like I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm not contributing.
Yeah, but again, Jim, that's a product of the situation.
Yeah.
That's not a product of what you are or not doing. I mean, it's just a situation that you're in. So
yeah,
but I enjoyed a lot of the sideline work I did before I got up in the booth, and I actually interviewed Burt Reynolds one time.
Really?
Yeah, at the Orange Bowl when Florida State under Bobby Bowden was trying to win the national championship.
Yeah, he was a former Florida State player. What was he like?
Short. Very short. As a matter of fact.
How short? Like, what are you like 6?
Well, they put him on a plastic milk crate.
Come on.
I'm dead serious. To stand next to me.
Burt Reynolds in the 70s was like a hunk of a man. They had to put him on a milk crate.
I'm dead serious. And we looked about the same height, but he was standing on a plastic milk crate. And I see him walking up to me, and he's got about 4 or 5 people with him with something in somebody's hand, and I wasn't exactly sure what it was until he got there. And he proudly just jumped up on it. He was excited about Florida State's chances and did the interview and jumped out and went away. And as I remember, Florida State won. I did a bunch of them, but I certainly remember that one.
Oh, the bandit had to step on a milk crate. Oh.
Yeah.
I'm hurt. That hurts me.
There's a picture of it somewhere. Somebody from NBC, their PR department, sent me a picture of it. This is before we had the internet. Sent me a picture of Burt Reynolds standing on that milk crate.
That is great.
You never know, do you? You never know.
When you look, just another broadcast, and when you look back, who are, just name drop, who are some people you talked to? Who are some of your favorite people that you came across, or anything that stood out that was unusual? Maybe not as unusual as Burt Reynolds standing on a milk crate.
It's a very short list. I know how football players feel, smell, what they feel like before and after a game, on all that stuff. I was never really impressed with talking with a football player, but I had Lee Trevino on my show, Jack Nicklaus on my show, but there were not interviews, but my broadcast career put me in a situation where, because of who I was, who I knew, and who knew me, I had the opportunity to play 2 days of golf with Jesse Owens.
Oh, wow.
And to play one day of golf with Neil Armstrong.
Oh.
I did a bunch of interviews with Bobby Knight. I did a bunch of interviews with Pete Rose. But those 3 days, 2 days with Jesse Owens and one round of golf with Neil Armstrong here in Cincinnati. Jesse Owens was in Dayton.
Wow.
At the Bogey Busters. By the way, I was invited to that tournament by Paul Brown. And when I was a track athlete in high school, along with playing basketball and football, and when I showed up at the MCR South and went over to my golf cart with my bag and realized that I was playing golf with Jesse Owens, Jim, I still get choked up about it. I got 2 days with Jesse Owens.
Gosh.
You speak of highlights of one's career. That was it. I didn't record anything. There was no interview. We were sitting in the same golf cart together and just shooting the breeze. And the same was true with Neil Armstrong. And when I first met him, I said, "Neil, I understand you don't like talking about going to the moon and back." And he said, "That's right." And I said, "To hell with that. We are talking about you going to the moon and back." And he started laughing. And I quizzed him the whole way around.
From what I've heard, he usually wins that battle.
Yeah, forget who was on the air. Those are the 3 days and the association with those two men that probably mean the most to me.
Wow. Well, I could hear it in your voice, Bob.
I'm not kidding. Every time I think about it, I'm a farm kid from Illinois.
Yeah.
And to think that I had 2 days with Jesse Owens, highlights of my life.
Oh, when you, I mean, you're right in my wheelhouse as far as heroes. Obviously, I never met Jesse Owens. I did not meet Neil Armstrong, which I
regret. He was, Jim, he was wonderful. He was absolutely wonderful. And I think the thing that we got along, this is weird, but I'm going to tell you this. The thing that connected us together is he knew I was a professional football player, and he knew I played for Paul Brown. And there was some connection with Paul. I don't remember what the connection was. And Paul was playing about two groups behind us, and Jesse and I both smoked. I don't know. I'm 27, 28 years old. He's in his 50s. And we're hiding from Paul Brown and sneaking smokes, and we don't want Paul Brown to see us smoking. And the two of us were like a couple of teenagers, you know, hiding behind the tree. It was, looking back on it, Jim, I'm telling you, it still gives me chills.
That is great. Well, listen, you got the hair standing up on my arm right now, because when you think about not only sports history, but just humankind history of Jesse Owens and 1936.
Yeah.
And I don't want to mention that evil idiot, Germany. I'm not even going to mention his name on this podcast, but you know who I'm talking about.
Yep.
For him and their race was the number, you know, everyone was not equal to their race, according to him. And for him to stare that situation down and perform like he did in not just sports history, but humankind, when they look back at the history of what led to World War II, they always mention Jesse Owens.
Yep, yep. I had the good sense to ask him if when he won the four medals and Hitler ignored him, did he realize then the influence that he had had on the rest of the world? And did he recognize how much attention he was going to get when he came back to the United States? And he said, no, remember, it was all on film, and film was transported to the United States. It took like 4 or 5 days to get it over here. We were on a ship. I had to wait till the end of the Olympics. So that was almost 10 days. And then the 4 or 5 day trip across the Atlantic Ocean. No, he said, I didn't. When we landed in New York, I had no idea that most of the celebration was about me. And I thought, oh, my God, you got to be kidding me.
Wow.
And he said, I was surprised. I was absolutely shocked. But I said, I asked him, how's your life? And he said, well, it's been a struggle. And I said, why? And he said, because I'm Jesse Owens and I won 4 Olympic medals. And all I can do is travel the country and talk about it. So, but... I don't remember anything other than that he was the kindest gentleman, and he had just gotten a graphite driver, and he called it the Black Widow, and I don't know why I remember that. That's really weird to remember. But anyway, some golf pro gave him a graphite driver back in the 70s. That was a big deal.
Big deal. Yeah. Wow.
And neither one of us was very good, but we loved playing golf and hiding from Paul Brown smoking.
Oh, I should redo your intro to this podcast. The Pro Football Hall of Fame for excellence in broadcasting, Super Bowls, Pro Bowl tight end, and once snuck away like a teenager to hide and get some smokes in with Jesse Owens.
With Jesse Owens. By the way, We haven't talked about professional football or the Bengals, but every year when the football season starts, just to give you a sense of in my beginnings, I was a 12th round draft choice for the Cincinnati Bengals. And I was telling some guys that I meet with at the bakery here where I live this morning, he said, "Do you remember the draft?" And I said, "No, not at all. I was working in Los Angeles." But when I got here, I, as a 12th round draft choice, were, you know, just another body. But I realized from the players that I met up there in Wilmington that in the fourth round, the Cincinnati Bengals took a guy who was physically, at the time he was drafted, he was physically in the Michigan State prison. Jesse Phillips. And I was drafted eight rounds later.
That puts it in perspective.
I thought, if you ever want to understand humble beginnings,
yeah,
they took a prisoner for eight rounds before me.
I got a little work to do. Cause
yeah, I lasted 10 years, and Jesse Phillips, I think, played for nine.
Wow.
You never know.
You just never know. And, boy, were times different then. That wouldn't happen now. And you certainly, anyways. By the way, just to backtrack here, I said it was in my wheelhouse. I am one of the biggest space nerds on the planet. And in fact, when I played sports, I wore number 11 because of Apollo 11.
Oh.
And Neil Armstrong was my guy. Still is my guy. I mean, I have things on that are recorded.
Far from Westerville, huh?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have things that are recorded. Like, even my wife goes crazy. Can we delete these? I'm like, no, that's like, you know, it's called Moonshot. I've got so many things of the Apollo program and Apollo 11 and Neil Armstrong recorded. I will not let her delete them. I watch them over and over and over again.
Really?
Yes. And I'm even they're in their descent to the moon. And I know what happens. They got 30 seconds of fuel left. And I'm still tense every time. I'm like, land it, Neil, land it. And so.
Yeah, you know, I asked him a question on that.
Did you?
It's well known, as you're talking about. Got 30 seconds worth of fuel.
Yeah.
And I said, Neil, what in the hell possessed you to think that you could fly something that couldn't fly? I mean, other than the reduced gravity, that's the only thing that's keeping that lunar module in the air, and the only movement is from this jet or that jet. What the hell possessed you to think that you could fly it? He said, nah, it wasn't that big a deal. What do you mean it wasn't that big a deal? And he said, well, the original landing spot, it was not going to work, and I had to find another one. Oh, okay. Well, let's just move this thing that doesn't fly over there, and it'll land properly. It was no big deal to him. I was absolutely astounded.
Well, that's part of the reason they chose him for that monumental mission, and he had proved it. We're turning this into space nerd talk. What the hell? It's my podcast. I don't care. When they were in training for that lunar module, flying it, he had a equipment malfunction or whatever, and he had to bail out of this training apparatus and nearly died. Had to parachute down to the ground, and the other astronauts say that right afterwards he went back in the office and started doing office work, and they asked him, hey, Neil, did you almost like bite it today? He's like, oh, yeah, malfunction. I parachuted to the ground. No big deal, and he just went about his day. So he was calm, cool, and collected. I hope you're enjoying our conversation with the one and only Bob Trumpy, and we will continue it after these words from Kroger.
Hey, Reds fans. Ritz Crackers, one of America's favorite cracker brands, has new Ritz Cheese Crispers that are bound to be a crowd pleaser for you and your family. The unique combination of real Ritz cheese and the crispy texture make these chips a must. These light, bite-sized, airy chips come in two delicious flavors, cheddar and four cheese and herb. Ritz Cheese Crispers are made with real rich cheese flavor that you can taste in every bite. They will defy your expectations for a delicious, cheesy snack. Get your new Ritz Cheese Crispers at Kroger.
Love getting prices that are lower than low on backyard favorites like grill-ready hamburgers and fresh-picked strawberries? Then shop at Kroger. We give you more ways to save on the fresh you love with tools like the Kroger app, where you can find personalized coupons on top of weekly sales, plus rewards like fuel points, giving you prices that are lower than the everyday low. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
All right, Bob, you were... Man, just a tremendous influence on so many people in broadcasting. Certainly me. I was a sports nerd.
You listened?
I listened all the time, nearly every night. I was, as I said, I was in Columbus, but once you hit WLW, I think 1980, around there.
Around there.
6 o'clock every night, they got this sports talk, and they got great guests, and Bob is great. And this and that, and although sometimes, you know, I was fanboy back then of the Reds. I'm like, oh, he's really getting after him tonight. He's getting after him.
Yeah, Jim, I got to tell you, I don't know that I would work on the air now because I was a long way from politically correct then, and probably even farther away from it now. And I can tell you honestly that the radio station was very understanding. I only had one incident where Marge Schott was the owner of the Cincinnati Reds, and she didn't like something I said, and she called the radio station and wanted me taken off the air. And the guy running the station was a guy named Bo Wood, and his dad started WEBN here in Cincinnati, the FM station.
Yeah.
Anyway, apparently Bo heard what I said, and Marge said, if he's on the air tomorrow night, we're canceling our contract. I didn't know any of this, and so the program ends, and Bo Wood comes in. And he said, you got me in a lot of trouble. Marge didn't like what you said. And he said, I think I got a way to get around this. And I said, what? And he said, I promised her that I would fine you for what you said. There would be no apology on the air, but I would, Bo said, I'm going to fine him enough money that he'll never say anything like that again on the air. And I don't remember what I said.
Wow.
And I said, well, how much is the fine? And he said, how much change you got in your pocket? I pulled out about 60 cents. And he said, let that be a lesson to you. And he took the 60 cents and left.
He had your back. That is great.
And that was it. And that was the only, as I remember, that was the only complaint I ever heard from anybody.
Well,
so.
That's where I was going to ask you, because back then it was a little different, and then all of a sudden sports talk comes along, and at that time, at least for WLW, like you said, it's a new genre, a new show, and all of a sudden someone's criticizing the hometown teams. I wondered how that went over when it first started, and what the feedback you got or backlash that you got.
Yeah, well. Actually, it was no problem. I was very respectful of, both the Reds and the Bengals. And sure, there are some things that they did that I didn't like. But, I was a football. I was not of baseball. And I honestly, Jim, I've racked my brain. I cannot remember what I said on the air that might have offended Marge Schott. But from what I've learned after that, It didn't take much to offend Mark. So, in fact, some people inside the organization, Chief Bender among them, said she probably didn't hear you say that. Somebody told her what they heard, and so it's second or third hand information. Yeah.
What they thought they heard.
By
the time it gets to the fifth person, it's a whole different story. Normally,
yes. Yes, exactly. Anyway, I thought it was a funny way for Bo Wood, who had to deal with Marge, 60 cents out of my pocket. So you never know.
You never know. Did you have a favorite gig in there? Was it the sports talk show that you had that you just mentioned? Was it
say favorite gig?
Gig, yeah.
No, I was doing golf.
I was going to say that was, wow, you see, I kind of sensed that that's where you were going, that the golf gig has to be the best.
Yeah, absolutely. I was flabbergasted when I got a call from NBC for me to, they wanted me to audition for golf in Honolulu.
Oh.
In 2 weeks.
Tough gig.
Yeah. And I said, the producer at that time was a guy named Larry Cirillo. And when I said, of course I'll audition for golf in Honolulu in 2 weeks.
Yes.
I have absolutely nothing else to do. So I get there, and we were staying at a place called the Kahala Hilton, which I still believe is one of the great hotels in the world. And the tournament was adjacent to the hotel. So it's a pretty good gig. But I finally got to the producer, again, named Larry Cirillo, and I said, why me? And he said, we know you play golf, and my wife loves your voice and thinks it would sound good doing golf. So that was my opportunity. And then I also knew back then we didn't have a lot of tournaments, and we were not connected to the PGA or the USGA that does all the opens, senior men's, women's, and kids. But we did the Bob Hope Desert Classic. We did the Hawaiian Open. There were the women's tournament on Maui, and they were building up the golf coverage. And so I passed the test, I guess. And I ended up doing that for, I think, 8 years. Three Ryder Cups, and that was, Jim, without question, the greatest sporting event I've ever been associated with, those three Ryder Cups.
Where were they? Where were the three?
One was at Kiowa. The other one was at the Belfry in England. And then the third was at Oak Hills in Rochester, New York.
Yeah, wow.
And I still just get chills thinking of standing on the practice tee, and Arnold Palmer walks up, and he's always giving me a dig about the Steelers beating the Bengals. Or Greg Norman walking up and saying, asking me, do you ever have knee surgery? I just had a procedure on my knee. And the friendship with Payne Stewart and Paul Azinger.
Oh, man.
They were great football fans and were always interested. And NBC supplied us with cars so we could go to the hotel and from the hotel at various tournaments. And one day I'm in the parking lot about to leave in Tiger Woods, and a guy named Mike Cowan, name on tour Fluff, who was his first caddy.
Columbus guy.
Yeah, I had met Fluff because he had been a caddy for Peter Jacobson. And Fluff waved to me, and I said, what's up? And he said, we need to ride back to the hotel. You mind? No. So Fluff and Tiger Woods get in the back of the car, and I'm a driver for the two of them back to wherever the hotel was. I don't remember. I know how football players feel, sweat, smell, you know, but to have those golfers, I aspired to be a golfer from a very young age, and I'm just too big to play golf, too tall, too many arms going 12 different directions. Yeah. I could never play it like those guys, but it was absolutely, doing the golf was the pinnacle, the zenith, as far as I was concerned. But the downside was, as NBC picked up more golf and then we signed on with the USGA, I couldn't do the radio show anymore. Yeah. I couldn't call a sports talk with Bob Trumpy and Bob Trumpy not be there as much as I was going to be gone. So
right.
Ended my sports talk.
Well, it's a good way to end it, though. I mean, that golf
yes.
game had to be tremendous.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was very nice. And I'm telling you, the Ryder Cup was king, absolutely king. I had the good fortune to take my attorney with me up to Rochester, New York, Reuben Katz. And he was an avid golfer. And we hung out with everybody, and everybody knew Reuben more than they knew me through his association with Bench, Rose, and Perez.
Yeah.
So it was great fun.
Oh, I bet.
And Brenneman. He represented Brenneman and
yeah.
Duxall and all kinds of people.
Oh, yeah. Now, speaking of Brenneman, I got to, you know, I had never met you until you came around the ballpark, and then I found out that you made this a tradition that at least one day a year during a weekday day game, you would come and sit in the booth with Marty every year,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Which I think is awesome because the pre-meal before the game in the press dining is always the, for us, the funnest part of the day because we're just shooting the breeze. And to be able to sit there and just be a fly on the wall and listen to you two talk was a joy.
Yeah, well, we don't treat each other with much respect.
I know, that's why it was so fun.
We love each other like brothers. Yeah, I think the thing that sealed it was this is during the sports talk era. We did a charity event for the Kidney Foundation, and included was Rose and Marty and Tom Brenneman spoke there. At that time, my broadcast partner was a guy named Sam Nover out of Pittsburgh. He flew in. Bryant Gumbel was going to fly in and then at the last second couldn't make it. But Brenneman was kind of a host, and I asked him to do it for the Kidney Foundation. And from that point on, it's very difficult for either one of us to be serious about anything when in each other's company. We are constantly ragging each other, and I get on him for the way he dresses, and he gets on me for who knows what. So it's never ending, and it's been going on for 50 years. And Nux used to be a part of it. Joe Nuxall was
yeah.
part of it. So we never stop just ragging each other unmercifully.
When you're sitting in the booth with Marty and Joe or just listening or whatever, you know what? When things are going on at the time, we don't realize, oh, hey, these are the best days of our lives, or you realize
yeah,
greatness.
Agreed.
Did you realize, I mean, just how special, how good those guys were at
you
the time?
You mean the Reds in the 70s?
Yeah, Marty and Joe.
Yeah. Oh, Marty and Joe, no. No, I had no idea. But I can tell you, Jim, that even during my playing career, you see, you got to understand that I grew up in Illinois in the middle of the state, a small town south of Peoria named Tremont. And then we moved to Springfield, which was the state capital of Illinois. And baseball to me was always a sound. It was never a sight. I went to one game in St. Louis, courtesy of my high school girlfriend's parents at the time, to see the St. Louis Cardinals play somebody. I don't remember who it was. But where I lived, I had one of those cheap Sony Japanese radios that, you know, about the size of a phone now, became a little leather case. And on a good night, I could hear Jack Brickhouse, broadcasting the Chicago White Sox from Chicago. And I could also hear Harry Carey and, what was the pitcher? The Wabash Cannonball for the St. Louis Cardinals, Dizzy Dean. I could hear Dizzy Dean from St. Louis. So baseball to me has always been a sound.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you how many nights I went to sleep, bothering the hell out of my wife, but went to sleep with the radio on, listening to Marty and Joe give the final out. I remember Seaver's no-hitter. I always listened at night, and Marty and Joe always treated me great. They welcomed me into the booth and enjoyed my company. I enjoyed theirs. And I told, when Nux died and they had the memorial at Hamilton High School, I drove up there and the line was out the building, around the parking lot about four or five times, down the street, up the hill, over to the next block, and I thought, I'm going to be here for days. And then Channel 5 was broadcasting the ceremony or whatever it was, and I saw one of the guys on the crew, and I said, is there a back door in this place? Do I have to get at the back of the line? And he showed me the back door, and I walked in and went through and saw Don Zetta and Kim and Jim Ferguson and his wife were there. And Brenneman came in. And when we got done, we walked out together out the back door, and I said, Brenneman, you understand, you and I are both going to hell because we cut in line in front of all those people to pay tribute to Nux. So you know that at some point we're going to be together in hell just doing that. And we laughed about that for 20 minutes. And Brenneman said, Nux would have loved that. So, I mean,
he would have definitely loved that.
You never know what's going to happen.
You never know. You know, you've had a career of you never know. In fact,
you never know.
It might be a title for your book.
You never know.
You never know. Have you ever written a book?
Yeah, Trump, 10 years with the Bengals.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But have you? How about your just the stuff we've talked about?
No.
Broadcast, yeah.
Yeah, no.
Well, there you go. You got a title if you ever do it. You never know.
You never know. Very good. You're absolutely right.
And you could just keep saying, you know, you tell a story and then
in
the chapter with, you just never know.
Yeah, you just never know.
What are you doing now? I know you've a longtime Cincinnati resident, and Illinois kid. And what made you stay here?
I'm professionally retired.
Yes.
I think I'm very good at it. I've lived in the same place for the same village for almost 50 years, and the same house for the last 30 years, and. Included on my property is what we refer to as a carriage house out in the back of the property. I have a big woodworking shop where I'm out there doing something almost every day. And I'm also, it turns out, I am a very good grandparent.
Nice.
So I got three here and three in Pennsylvania that I try to keep constant contact with. And Mrs. Trumpy and I are doing fine.
That is tremendous.
It's 54 years of marriage.
54 years.
Yep. I knew her 3 weeks, married her in 2 months, and 54 years later, we're still together.
You just never know.
Yep. She was crazy back then, and she's crazy now to hang around.
I can relate, although I'm only 10 years in.
10?
Only 10. I got married later. And yeah,
you sure did.
Got married later, but wow. I'm so happy to hear that you're doing well, and 54 years of marriage, and what a career to look back on, and your grandkids. I'm sure everyone listening right now is happy to hear that Bob Trumpy's doing well, because I know there are thousands out there like me that you are just, I mean, we logged hundreds of hours listening to you. Thousands of hours listening to you.
I appreciate you being interested.
Oh, are you kidding me? I want to have, I have, like I told you off the air, I could talk to you for 8 hours straight about stuff. I mean, there's stuff I could bring up and get into that might spur some memories. I would love to have you back sometime if you're interested in the future.
Sure. I don't know what we've left out, but sure.
Oh, there's plenty.
No problem.
Left out. Plenty left out. Well, maybe we'll hook up you and Marty on the same podcast.
Oh my gosh.
How about that?
I'm not sure that's even broadcast worthy.
Oh, I got bleeps. I can bleep out stuff.
I need a censor.
I'll be the censor, and I can bleep some stuff out.
We're supposed to have lunch in a couple of weeks, so
it'll
be right back to where we're at. That's the one thing about Brenneman and I. I haven't seen him since a year and a half ago when he was last in the booth.
Yeah.
And I was there for my annual visit in the booth. That's the last time I saw him. But 30 seconds into us being together again, we'll be right back to where we were a year and a half ago or 50 years ago.
Yeah, that is
ragging on each other unmercifully.
Yep, that is the beauty of true friendships and lifelong friendships.
I agree with you. I there's several people that I've kept in contact with. Same way. I called Costas the other day, not the other day, last fall when he announced that he was retiring.
Mm-hmm.
And 30 seconds into a conversation with him, we're right back to where we were. I'm tall and he's short, and we never fit in the picture. And he looked like a emblem on my sport coat.
And, no Burt Reynolds milk crate around.
Yeah, absolutely. It never stopped. And he, by the way, was getting his driver's license renewed in the city of New York. And he called me I called him at like 9:15 in the morning. He said, I'll call you when I get done getting my license. He called me back at 3:30. And I said, what the hell is this? You really treat me nicely, you know? You call me back at 3:30. He says, hey, I just got done. What? You showed up at 9:15 to get your license renewed and you're done at 3:30? Why are you still staying there? And he's a New York kid, top to bottom.
Yeah,
so,
no doubt. Well,
it never ends.
This has been tremendous. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I love a conversation when I learn something I didn't know, like you spending a couple days with Jesse Owens and how emotional it made you, and Neil Armstrong and Burt Reynolds. He was one of those guys that I think everyone idolized in the 70s, wanted to be Burt Reynolds, but he had to stand on a milk crate to be.
Yeah, I guarantee you, Jim, you're much taller than Burt Reynolds is.
I'm about 6'2.5", 6'3", so yeah.
This is my first podcast, and it's gone very comfortably.
This is the first podcast?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
I'm still not sure exactly what it is.
We need some. Well, you know, it's just like a regular radio interview, but it's just on demand where people can pick it up and listen anytime. So
you explained it to me. I understand.
I am honored to do the first podcast with you. That is, now, if I would have said back then when I'm a little young guy listening to Bob Trumpy, who I'm like, I want to be Bob Trumpy. And one day, even though I wouldn't have known what a podcast, what the hell that was at the time, like, I'm going to record the first podcast with Bob Trumpy. Wow.
Well,
feather in my cap, my friend.
I would hope when you think back on it, just as I described the radio show, that it was, you never know. It's just a safari. You just never know.
And we'll end it on that. Appreciate it, Bob. Godspeed to you and your family, and enjoy the grandkids, and your wood shop and just enjoy life. You deserve it.
Yep, I do.
That is Bob Trumpy, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for checking us out here on the Jim Day podcast. And as we said on down the road, who's going to be on the podcast? Well, you just never know. Till next time, so long, everyone.